Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's lecture, the famous and infamous Vanglo Jewry. Tonight, we are going to be exploring the life of Sir Moses Montefiore. When I say his name, I can't help but hear his name being said by Rabbi Abraham Levy, of the formerly the head of the Spanish Borges community, the head of the Montefiore Endowment. So I think of his inflection and when he talks about Sir Moses. This is a figure. Sir Moses is a figure which, I guess, really with all the figures that we're talking about last time, Daniel Mendoza, next time Benjamin Disraeli, that I certainly have kind of one impression about these individuals before kind of delving into their lives. And I would say almost kind of thinking about them in ways that feels like our kind of interest in kind of associating Bevis Marks with them is a bit kind of sensational and, you know, kind of this, you know, wanting to just kind of, you know, hang our hat on their peg, you know, and kind of be connected with them. But the more I learn about them and realize kind of how significant figures they were, and that it's not just about, oh, famous person and trying to connect ourselves to them, but really kind of appreciating how significant they were, what they meant for Anglo-Jewry, and really in a way that's different than Mendoza and Disraeli, that with Montefiore, really the significance for world Jewry. Montefiore was a truly a global phenomenon. A really important figure. He lives from 1784 to 1885. I mean, he lives for a century. And he is, in that way, a profoundly important figure because he really acts as a bridge between kind of two moments in the history of Anglo-Jewry, of world Jewry, where historians would kind of think of, you know, kind of the 17th and 18th centuries as early modern kind of history, early modern, which is kind of a mix between medieval and modern. And then you get to the 20th century, where we would say kind of we're firmly in the modern era. And then you have this 19th century, which really kind of finds itself caught. There are some extra chairs around, feel free to grab. Really kind of caught between the two. And Montefiore, in a sense, caught between the two time periods, but actually plays a role in transitioning from, shall we say, from the 18th to kind of the 20th century. He plays that that role during the 19th century, and as we'll see, he plays the function in terms of kind of the way that Jewish communities operate changes. From a focus on individuals, what we might think of as the court Jews or the shtadlanim, or kind of figures that have close relationships with significant figures that kind of play roles with government and so on, to this kind of new moment where. This new moment where all of a sudden we're thinking about communal organizations and the role that they play, right? So with Montefiore, we'll think of Montefiore as the individual and the role he plays, and then you think of, you know, the Board of British Deputies, which for, you know, 40 years essentially is Montefiore, but it will kind of, obviously, will have a life after him as well. As well as thinking about the role of world Jewry and how, you know, there's always been a consciousness of, you know, world Jewry, Kol Yisrael Revin Zeh B'Zeh, you know, we're all related to one another and kind of the sense of, you know, the collective Jewish identity. But in a practical sense, the pre-modern times, communities operated locally, you know, independently of one another. And it's during this time that the world becomes interconnected. And Montefiore will play a really important role in ensuring that Jews the world over are concerned about the plight of Jews in places of the world where they do not live. And he will take the lead on those efforts. And so he plays a really important role in really developing this sense of collective identity, not just from, you know, from a theoretical framework to one which actually means something in a practical kind of way. And so in that sense, he really becomes this this towering figure. And what I love about Montefiore is that there are all these legends associated with him. You know, you don't get legends associated with you unless you really are a significant figure, and then legends develop. And sometimes we don't know whether all these legends are true, and maybe some of them aren't. It doesn't really matter for our purposes, because what they mean is that he really just becomes a symbol to people. He becomes he becomes greater than just a man. And that's because he does incredibly significant things in his life, and kind of is at that important moment in time and acts with it. He really kind of grabs the moment and goes with it, and will do so. I mean, for decades upon decades upon decades of his life. So that's why I love, you know, the fact that there are legends about him. It's because, well, we don't all deserve to have legends written about us, but he does. But they do. I think the legends, whether they are true or not, tell us something about him, right? The fact that you write kind of a legend develops means that still those values are associated or kind of thought of, that this story could have happened, does still say something about who the person was and what they meant. So that is the introduction to Sir Moses. So if you didn't think he was awesome yet, now you do. Really important figure. But before I begin, by show of hands, how many people in this room are related to Moses Montefiore? I know we at least have one. Okay, good. Are there any other people related to Sir Moses? Wow, okay. We did Mendoza. There were like 10 people here that were related. So good. Welcome. Welcome, Ted. Okay, that's important to know, so I know who I have to be careful about during the interview. What stories I can't tell, you know. Okay. So let's begin. So who was Sir Moses? Let's talk about, you know, little Mo. You know, I don't know what he was called as a child, but little Moses. He was born in 1784 in the city of Livorno in Italy. The British sometimes refer to it as Leghorn for some reason, but it's called Livorno. He wasn't really from Livorno. His grandfather had been from Livorno. His grandfather had already moved to London in the earlier 1700s, but there were lots of family connections that remained in Livorno, and so they would travel back and forth. And he was actually born when his parents were back in Livorno. Livorno had been an incredibly important Western Sephardic community. Everyone's kind of familiar with Amsterdam and then London, but Livorno not so much, because Livorno really declines in the 1800s to the extent that nowadays people don't think of it, but actually was second to Amsterdam in size and prominence. It was a larger community than the Western Sephardic community in London. So I'll just show you just a couple pictures here of it. That was the synagogue that was there. It was built in 1695, this particular building. It had been enlarged and really was an incredibly impressive building that was kind of known throughout Europe as perhaps the most beautiful synagogue in Europe. Unfortunately, it was destroyed in World War II. Livorno had been taken over by the Nazis as an important shipping. I mean, that's what had made Livorno important in earlier centuries was its shipping industry, and the Allies bombed. They bombed it a lot, the synagogue was hit during Allied bombings and was destroyed. This is the current synagogue. They built a new synagogue there. Western Sephardic, but very modern, very different than kind of the classic Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, but they do have a synagogue there. And outside of the synagogue is a plaque which is dedicated to the fact that Sir Moses was born across the street. And this used to be on the building across the street that no longer exists, And so now it's affixed to the synagogue itself. No one really goes to Livorno, but I went there so I could take this photo for all of you. Okay, so his family, so his father is a Montefiore. His mother is a Macada. So Macada is a famous kind of Spanish-Portuguese family name here in London. And of course, the family went to Bevis Marks. He was a lifelong member and devotee of this synagogue. In fact, even till this day, he's remembered the seat and where he used to sit is still roped off out of kind of reverence for him and all he did for Anglo-Jewry. And so nobody sits in his seat except for special figures, which maybe we'll refer to a little bit later. He was not particularly wealthy for some time. His early endeavors were, not particularly successful. He had been involved in a case of where he, essentially he became what was known as one of these Jew brokers. Only a certain number of brokers were permitted on the Royal Stock Exchange. Only 12 Jews were allowed. He had become one of them. But it seems at one point he perhaps loses his license because there had been some kind of, someone had kind of taken advantage. There had been, at that time, things weren't really regulated, and there were lots of sometimes, shall we say, fake news stocks being sold. He got caught up on that and made some bad deals, became impoverished, and perhaps even lost his license as a result. But he does eventually, in 1815, get his license back again, and that will start his rise in wealth to the extent that he will retire by 1820. Okay, talk about a quick rise. Now, part of the reason for his rise is the fact that in 1812. He has the fortune to marry Judith Cohen. Judith Cohen is a nice Ashkenazi girl. She is the sister of Henrietta Cohen, who has the good fortune of marrying Nathaniel Rothschild, of the great Rothschild banking family. And Mishpacha, yeah. So as a result of this, he ends up going into business with his wife's brother-in-law, Nathaniel. Nathaniel is a banker, and Montefiore becomes their broker. And so all of the deals that essentially this kind of banking industry is engaging in, they end up, he does the deals for them, right, with tremendous amounts of money, which is made off of kind of the rights for having handled the deals for them. And he becomes fabulously, fabulously wealthy. I mean, multi-millionaire. And this incredible thing that, in 1820, he retires and spends the next 60 years of his life, and he lives till he's 100, involved in philanthropy. He really sets the bar for philanthropy in the world, where he becomes kind of the model that other philanthropists will follow, other wealthy barons of industry will follow. Well, they'll look at it and say, just because you're incredibly rich, right, actually means that you have a responsibility to do something with your wealth, and will, in that sense, kind of create the kind of the expectation that other people who kind of make that kind of wealth, you think of Carnegie and figures like that, who also do kind of philanthropy around the world, right, kind of following. And Montefiore is a worldwide sensation for doing this. He's written about in the press just this amazing thing that this wealthy person is really just spending their life trying to help others. He continues to be involved in some types of business. He invests in gas, which is a new industry, kind of having gas lighting and things like that. He gets involved in insurance and all these things end up kind of being successful for him. He's involved in banking. And so on. So, in all these different ways, he ends up, being successful in business, having lots of connections, and kind of rising up the social ladder of England. And really becomes kind of one of these gentlemen. There's a great picture, I don't have it here, of him, you know, kind of standing with his hands behind his back with like the jacket kind of flipped out. You know, he looks like one of these, you know, dandy, you know, gentlemen from that time. He's 6'3", he's tall, he's you know, he's very good looking, he's very wealthy, he's a real kind of presence. And he really rises kind of in the image and his place within society. And he involves himself in all kinds of philanthropy to Jewish and non-Jewish causes. And so he really is kind of seen as this, you know, great example of someone who is not, you know, particularistic. He really kind of cares for all, you know, part of this humanist time in England, and really kind of is one of these, is very much this great example of what it means to be a great humanist, right? Because he's helping, you know, all kinds of people in England and without. He also has a increasing public profile as well, in kind of an official capacity. He will be elected the Sheriff of London. Yeah, the Sheriff of London in 1836. Now, the Sheriff of London doesn't actually go around arresting people, but the Sheriff of London, like the Lord Mayor, kind of becomes somewhat of a, eventually, a symbolic position, you know, but an important kind of official kind of representative of the City of London. There are some challenges. Can he assume the position? Can't he? In 1837, he's knighted by the Queen. And so that becomes, you know, kind of significant that now he becomes Sir Moses, he's the sheriff, right? So there's kind of all of this kind of now kind of mystique, right, kind of going with it. Here's this Jew who's getting this kind of royal recognition. He has this kind of national or, you know, kind of important place within society, right? So all of these things is just increasing and increasing his kind of the aura around him. There's a great story with him and the Queen. That apparently as a child that the Queen lived next door, that when she was a child had lived next door to him, and that he had given her a key to his garden so that she could go inside and play in the garden whatever she wanted. That's one of these stories that, again, there's no evidence for it, but it's one of these stories that's told. And it's very nice and kind of, again, draws the sense of that there was this connection between him and the Queen that kind of perhaps goes back in this very kind of very personal, sweet type of relationship. But there's a great story about him and becoming sheriff. The story goes that normally the Lord Mayor show, right, kind of when they induct the Lord Mayor and the sheriff, takes place on Saturday, on Shabbat. And he told them, and they, you know, they were going to send the carriage, you know, kind of the City of London carriage to pick him up. And he said, well, I can't do that because it's Shabbat. And he said, don't worry, it's okay, I'll walk. And they said, no, we can't, that's like too embarrassing. So they apparently had switched it to Sunday. But apparently because the food wasn't kosher, he brought his own chicken with him to the feast. So just again, I don't know whether all these stories are true, but just great stories that kind of characterize this really interesting thing that we're going to start seeing about Montefiore, that he is a devoted Jew, but he is, you know, kind of this really, you know, what we think of when we think of this gentlemanly Brit, right? He also is that person. And he's both of them within the same, you know, within the same figure. And I think that story really kind of captures the way that the two work. And, you know, you talk about, you know, even today, you know, Anglo-Jewry, you know, we're kind of, you know, do we walk around with our kippah in public? Don't we, right? Kind of this thing. He's very kind of public. I mean, I don't know if we wore kippah, but he's, you know, he's very public. It's very obvious that he is a Jewish person. It's part of his identity, but he doesn't see that as a contrast to him also being, you know, part of society in kind of the, in the highest type of way, the most public type of way. One of the important things is that in 1835, so around the same time, he becomes the head of the British Board of Deputies, which of course is this board that represents Jewish concerns in England and perhaps even internationally, and he becomes its president, and he will remain in that position until 1874. So a very, very, very long time, and, you know, often, there'll be these things where he says, well, I don't think I should continue. But then they say, out of like respect, no, you should. And he goes, okay, well, if you want me to, then I will. He carries on for a very long time in that role. Now he lives in London, and he's obviously very well. First, let me just do this. This is his beloved wife Judith. That was his wife. She dies. We'll talk about her passing a little bit later, but she dies in 1862, right? So many, many years before he passes. And he mourns her for the rest of his life. There's stories of him just kind of sitting by her grave for long amounts of time, and that really kind of deeply impacted him. They had a very close relationship, and we'll see why as we go forward. But one of the things that was important was that they actually there's a great picture here. This is an etching of him being knighted by the Queen, which is cool. So you can see the whole ceremony taking place there, which is really nice. And then here we have, he eventually kind of, as any good English gentleman does, he has to have his seaside home, and he chooses to do that in Ramsgate. He'll have a very beautiful home that has a famous history of other people that had lived there before him. And of course, he needs to have a synagogue. So he builds a synagogue. On the premises or nearby. Oh, let's see. Did I just lose that? Let's see. Oh, no internet connection. Okay, so we seem to have lost our... Let's see if I can connect us. Wait, now let's get the box. Let's see. Not sure why our internet is not connecting. Let me see if I can connect to this other one. Oh, there we go. Okay. Come on. This is my blog. So that's the synagogue in Ramsgate. That's the exterior. And here is the interior. It's really beautiful. And it's still there. They have events there several times a year. You can, especially in the summer, they'll have some events on the anniversary of when he died and so on. And so the synagogue is still there. And it was operational for a very long time. And well into the 1900s, there was a Jewish community that was in Ramsgate as well. And he had, he really kind of was the father, of that community in a lot of different ways, as well as the non-Jewish community there. He was a great philanthropist to many local causes in Ramsgate as well. Okay, so one of the things that becomes kind of significant in his and Judith's life is the fact that they don't have any children. They don't have any children. Which may play a role partly in his decision to kind of devote his life to philanthropy, right? Kind of wanting to give, he doesn't have children. He'll be very close with his nephew, Joseph Sebag Montefiore, to whom he will ultimately bequeath most of his wealth. He will give, he'll create many endowments and so on, right? But kind of ultimately the estate and so on, right, will go to his nephew. But there's this great story. I was shopping in one of the kosher stores in Northwest London last year and trying to buy some wine for Shabbat, and the person showed me different wines there, and he goes, oh, we have this new wine, this Montefiore wine. And I said, oh, that's okay, cool. He shows me, he goes, yeah, this is great. This wine was produced, by his direct descendant, trying to get me to buy the wine. And I started laughing at him. I said, but he didn't have any children. And he goes, oh, well, I don't know. So it's from a different branch of the, I think through the Joseph Sebag branch of the family. And maybe David can tell us something about that later if anyone's interested in purchasing some of that wine. But in any case, so he didn't have any children, and that will play a kind of important role kind of in their lives, you know, and kind of the relationship between him and Lady Judith, you know, and the fact of kind of how close they will be and how much they will kind of jointly participate in many of his philanthropic activities, and we'll see some kind of images later that will capture the way that they did these things together. Does anyone have any questions? That's kind of the basic outline. Yes?
Why did the family move to London from Livorno?
There were lots of people that moved from Livorno to London in the 1700s. There is a growing prominence to, that is the kind of the age of the British Empire, the American British Empire at that time. There's lots of trade between Livorno and London, and then of course London, New World, so a lot of people are kind of getting drawn here. There's economic opportunities. There's a very strong link between Livorno and London in the way that kind of in the 1600s people thought about the very strong link between Venice and Amsterdam. In the 1700s, it's kind of Livorno and London are the real kind of economic powerhouses of the Western Sephardic world. Yeah. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about the context, because the context for his life is going to be really important, because I talk about this kind of transition time. So we kind of talk a lot about, from particularly the Jewish narrative, of kind of, you know, what is early modern, you know, what is modern, right? So with modern, we think of kind of emancipation, full rights. Jews are just citizens like anybody else, right? We happen to be Jews, but from the eyes of the state, we're just citizens like anybody else, or we don't have any... there's no collective identity anymore. We are all just seen as individual citizens, right? When you think of medieval Jewry or even early modern Jewry, oftentimes there is the Jewish community, right? We talk of the Jewish community today, but that's only because we choose to have a Jewish community, right? But in earlier times, that was an official structure that existed, right? And we weren't seen as individuals, we were seen as members of this community that had particular regulations that governed us, right? That vis-a-vis the state, right? Vis-a-vis the king or the bishop, whatever the case may be, and that essentially Jews were members, not of the larger society, we were members of this this institution, the Kahal, the Jewish community. And there is a transition that takes place between kind of this, the Jews are just part of this collective kind of sub-state within the state, to us being seen just as individuals as far as the state is concerned. And how that process of emancipation happens is different in every place. In some places, Jews remain part of this structure much longer than they do in other places. In certain places... you know, overnight, you know, you think of the American Revolution, overnight, Jews are just citizens of the United States. There's nothing, there is no Jewish community in terms of how the government sees it. And in England, it's kind of this, while there's never really been a structured Jewish community that kind of negotiated with the authorities, right? That's what Menashe ben Israel had tried to do with Cromwell, that failed, and then later just Jews are here, right? So Jews kind of here are in this funny position where we are here just as individuals, but there are limits on what we can do as Jews. So as a Jew, you can't trade within the city of London. As a Jew, you can't, you know, own a ship. As a Jew, you can't be a broker unless you're one of the 12, right? So there's restrictions on us as individual Jews, but we are individuals. So essentially in every country, the kind of the process towards emancipation, which we might say emancipation means really the fact that you are a Jew is irrelevant in terms of what you can do and what your status is. Oftentimes the final thing which identifies kind of what we would say is full emancipation is that Jews are permitted not only to vote, but to be elected to high office and to assume those positions. In this country, that won't happen until 1858, right? That the first Jew will be able to join parliament and will not be barred from doing so, even if elected, because they're unwilling to take the oath of office, which invokes Christianity, right? And it won't be until 1858 that the first Jew can actually do that, can take the oath and not have to reference Christianity. So in different countries, in different places, it will go at different speeds. But that is something which is happening certainly in England. And that's the world. And that's going to play a major part in a lot of Montefiore's efforts, will be this question of kind of Jewish status and Jewish rights, right? Not just here, but really kind of globally. And that will end up kind of being a thing that will be concerned, right? Something that concerns him about local place here, but will also concern about him more broadly. I mean, he becomes the Sheriff of London in 1836. The first Jew to ever do it was 1835, and which was his nephew. So, you know, so basically, you know, it's this kind of weird kind of place, you know, in this history of kind of Jewish emancipation, right? And he kind of finds himself existing kind of before it begins, during that transition, and then kind of after when it's been concluded, and that will very much be a part of where he is. And so, as a result of that, he ends up getting involved in a series of international affairs in which Jews find themselves in compromised positions, and he will do so as this, you know, Sir Moses. He gets a baronet as well in the 1840s, right? So he really kind of has all these kind of like symbolic kind of places. He's very wealthy. He's very involved. People know that he has relationships with people in government, and this is the height of the British Empire, right? The sun does not set on the British Empire, right? This is their height, right? Where they have this kind of this global reach, perhaps, right? This time, the most powerful, you know, empire on earth, and this Jew is part of that, and that positions him, in a sense, to often negotiate on behalf of Jews, not only as just some other Jew, but as someone who almost is negotiating as a representative of the British Empire, okay? And oftentimes he will enter into these negotiations, in a sense, with their permission to kind of go to these places. And it gives him incredible amounts of, if not power, kind of sway on these issues, because nobody really wants to be on the wrong side of the empire. And there will be all kinds of politics involved, because at this point there'll be great kind of jockeying position between the British and the French and their role within the Mediterranean and kind of their colonial role within the Mediterranean, not to mention the role of Jews in France and kind of the fact that they want to be the ones kind of helping world Jewry, and England's Jews wanting to be the ones representing world Jewry, and each of them kind of doing it in a way where they're trying to bring glory to their particular countries and thinking that the French way is better or the British way is better. And it's all kind of mixing to each other, and sometimes they will bump heads. There's a figure, I think his name is Crémieux in France, that Montefiore will often, who's a Jew, who Montefiore will often kind of, they'll have some kind of complicated relationships on dealing with some of these international affairs and what's the right way to deal with them, publicly, privately, and some of those things will play out. But the first major, major event that Montefiore becomes involved with is the Damascus Affair. The Damascus Affair is where a Jew is accused of committing a blood libel in Damascus, because a Christian child has gone missing, and accusations are brought that the Jews are responsible for this, right? Because they need the blood for Passover, right? This is 1840, okay, and the French are deeply involved in Damascus. And of course, they're Catholic, and they essentially seem to side with this blood libel, and it leads to a series of you know, disturbances against the Jewish community. Many Jews are taken are imprisoned, and there is also, you know, some destruction of Jewish property that's happening, and this becomes kind of this, you know, this cause in England, because, you know, it's just another, you know, act of the kind of the backwardness of the Catholic Church, you know, and look, they're still so backwards, and, you know, us British Protestants, you know, we are, you know, modern and forward thinking, right? So part of this is dealing with, okay, Damascus, and we think of that as Middle Eastern, but it's actually a bit of a conflict between the French and the English that's actually playing out over here. So Montefiore actually goes to engage within this issue. He meets the Sultan. Let's see if we have this here. Yeah, he meets with the Sultan, and this will really kind of kick off his involvement in international affairs, and where time and time again, he is meeting leaders of states, and he is a Jew meeting with leaders of states, where the Jews in those places would never get to meet with the leaders of those states, and yet this Jew from England with his red uniform, right, he is kind of, you know, this almost royalty seeming to them, is able to kind of just step in and have this direct line to world leaders and to intervene for the benefit of Jews the world over. And he will play a very important role in getting the Sultan to admit that the Jews, that the blood libels are completely false, there is no such thing, Jews don't do this, and certainly the Jews are not responsible for this, and essentially stating, that those Jews that have been imprisoned should be freed, and really kind of setting the tone to say that, you know, blood libel accusations can never be made because they're simply not true. Despite the fact that in the French press, they will be writing about the fact that, yes, Jews do these things, right? So there's like this really kind of, it's part of this complicated world of the 1800s where it's the French and the British fighting over an issue because of each of them have this foothold in what's happening in the Middle East, but it's the Sultan who ultimately is still the representative of those places. It all becomes a bit complicated, and he's wading into these affairs. The next major event he has is with the Tsar of Russia in 1846, also because of some kind of disturbances against the Jews there. But perhaps one of the most famous kind of involvements of Montefiore is with the Pope. And this takes place in 1858, and this is associated with the affair of Edgardo Mortera. Edgardo Mortera is a Jewish child who is on his deathbed, apparently while on his deathbed, his Catholic caregiver baptizes him, and then he gets better. And she reports this to the Catholic Church, and they say, well, you know, maybe she shouldn't have baptized him, but now that he's been baptized, he is a Catholic and now needs to be raised by the Catholic Church. And he is abducted from his family. It's not the first time this has happened to Jews. This is something that did happen from time to time in Italy. And it becomes this, you know, again, this major affair, kind of the world over, of, you know, the kind of this barbarity, you know, of this thing that this child is taken from his parents. He's taken by the Catholic Church. Again, in England, this is going to be, look at those Catholics again. And there's this kind of big movement, this uproar in England. And there'll be all kinds of efforts. And the Pope keeps kind of just saying, well, you know, like I can't, there's nothing I can do. He was baptized, and therefore it is what it is. And apparently at one point, Montefiore does go and tries to negotiate. And there's kind of this moment, says, they won't let the parents see the child. So it's a couple years before the parents are actually even able to see their child. And they say, well, let's go see what he says. And the parents go to the child, you know, and the child essentially, you know, disavows his parents. And he says, no, I'm a good Catholic. I don't want to be a Jew. You know, and it's this heartbreaking, I think his mother died. It's this like heartbreaking story, you know, but he's been for several years, you know, essentially brainwashed by these priests. And they say, well, you know, he doesn't want to go back to you, and therefore, you know, it would be cruel for us to now force him to go back to you. And essentially, Montefiore, in a sense, fails, right? He doesn't succeed in his efforts. But again, it's like once again how, you know, Montefiore is kind of, you know, when something bad happens, he is the address that you go to, and he flies into action, you know, no matter where in the world it takes place. And we'll see, traveling this time is not easy, and yet he goes and he does what he can, you know, in these efforts. And people say that that effort actually really undermined the Catholic Church, the position of the Pope in a great way, because it kind of brought the world, you know, this kind of recognition of, you know, kind of the twistedness of kind of some of these laws, you know, that the Catholic Church was operating by. A few years later, in 1864, there will be hostilities taking place against the Jews in Morocco. Again, a question of some of their rights, and you know, people attacking Jews there, and so on. And he actually goes to Morocco, and he meets with the Sultan of Morocco. This is a picture of him being greeted there. This is kind of the everyone kind of assembled, this great assembly to kind of welcome him to it. There's some discussion about was he authorized by the British to do this mission? Wasn't he? Did he just kind of do it and force the British their hand? That once he went, they kind of had to recognize his authority there. Again, there's all kinds of complications. The French are there. There's all kinds of complications going on with all these places. But again, Montefiore is at the forefront. And I'll just mention just two others. He goes to Romania in 1867, right? There's going to be increased pogroms against Jews in these places. And there's been, again, different wars taking place. And there, and a lot of these things end up starting being politics between, you know, the Tsar and the West and who has influence in Eastern Europe. I mean, a lot of stuff that's happening even today is something that's been happening for centuries in Eastern Europe about, you know, kind of which powers, in a sense, have influence within Eastern Europe. And apparently there's been some treaty where, technically speaking, the Romanian government has said that they recognize, you know, the rights of all of their citizens. And yet, they're not ready to defend the rights of all their citizens, which people interpret as that we have the right to do to the Jews whatever we want. And there will be a series of pogroms against Jews that will be there. Montefiore will go there, he'll negotiate, he'll get assurances that it'll be fine. He goes back to England, and then it happens again. He feels, you know, like he's been lied to. It's a really unfortunate event, but it's really just this precursor to, you know, growing hostility towards Jews in Eastern Europe, to the extent that in 1872, right, in 1872, I mean, he's essentially 90 years old. He goes to Russia again to meet the Tsar, again, to deal with this issue of, you know, what is the legal status of Jews in the Pale. There's been laws that have said that Jews can't own land, and so Jews are forced to be in poverty. He wants them, you know, to change those laws. They're agreeing, they're not agreeing. It's a mess. I mean, it really is kind of, is he succeeding? Is he not succeeding? You know, he's this old man at this point. You know, there's these stories of him going as an old man. You can see actually the picture in the back over there of him as an old man, but still dressed in his uniform, which at that point is a very dated type of uniform. But he's, you know, he's become a little bit, you know, well, he's still living in his past a little bit, and, you know, what it means, the fact that he has this uniform. And, well, you know, things are becoming bigger than him. You know, there's world politics going on, and Jews are stuck in the middle, and Jews are used as pawns. In any case, each of these things, you know, he comes back to England, they'll make parades for him and celebrating his efforts and his success, and he'll just continue to kind of grow as he is, you know, when there is a problem in the Jewish world, he is the address for it. He is the person that you go to. I don't think there has been in all of Jewish history a figure like Moses Montefiore. We have a famous saying, Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ki Moshe, which usually refers to Maimonides, that says from Moses, you know, of the Torah to Moses Maimonides, there has never been a Moses like him. Well, I think we can add this Moses too. I mean, really, what he meant to Jews the world over was profound. One of the things that he does, and this will be kind of part of that transition, is he starts using campaigns, public campaigns, to raise funds towards causes. This will be during this time, starting in the 1830s, the beginning of the press, the Jewish press, and he will use the press as a way to engage a broader audience to participate in causes. And so they will call for subscriptions to causes, you know, so send in 1 pence, send in 2 pence, and that way everyone kind of who gets this paper can kind of send in their contribution and collectively can raise funds towards these causes, right? So even though he has money, it's not just about his money, it's about trying to get everybody involved. And he does a number of efforts. Sometimes they're more successful than other times. Sometimes, you know, it's been too close perhaps since the last one. They're less successful. But he basically initiates these fundraising campaigns where he's trying to engage Anglo-Jewry. And not only Anglo-Jewry, actually English people in general. He will be generous towards causes that matter to Christians. So when Christians are raising funds for Christians that are being oppressed in Eastern Europe, perhaps from, again, Muslim-Christian tensions in Eastern Europe, and he contributes and gets a lot of kind of publicity for that. So then he'll turn to Christians to say, you know, and there'll be this kind of, you know, at this time kind of this seemingly, oh, this beautiful kind of humanistic kind of collective, you know, pursuit of, you know, human rights around the world, right? How more British is that than fighting for human rights around the world? You know, and it's Jews and non-Jews doing it together. But that's an important transition, right, between just kind of individuals, but kind of the Jewish community as a whole. The thing that perhaps one of the most important things that he does is his activities in Israel, in the Holy Land. He will travel to the Holy Land 7 times in his life. It takes months to travel there. There are stories of storms at sea. There's this great story of a storm at sea where it's, you know, he thinks that the boat is going to sink, and he invokes an ancient Livornese Jewish custom where you take a piece of matzah of the afikoman that's been the leftover from the afikoman that you ate on Passover, and apparently Jewish merchants from Livorno would always carry a piece of the afikoman from the previous Passover, and should they be caught in a storm, they would toss it into the sea, that it should be an omen for, I guess, as the, you know, when the sea split and it was peaceful, right, so that this should invoke that, and it should be peaceful. And he writes in his diaries that lo and behold it was, and they survived. He's got this great story where, you know, so basically you have to kind of go through Italy. He would often stop in Italy and then make his way down. You'd go to Egypt, right, to Cairo or Alexandria, and then from there you would go up to Jaffa. That was kind of the path that you took. And one time there's conflict in the Eastern Mediterranean, there's pirates, it's not safe. So he ends up having to stay in Egypt for months at a time. And apparently it's hot, he gets sick, it's not good for his wife. And he writes in his diary, you know, he says, you know, how happy he is to leave Egypt. And, you know, he goes, the plagues never left Egypt. You know, they're still, it's still there. But amazing descriptions of what the Jewish community there looked like and so on. Anyways, he goes to Israel several times. It's difficult. He has to travel there. You know, even there, it's not completely safe. But there's great descriptions of these entourages. You know, here's like this British, you know, in his uniforms, traveling, you know, around with everyone. There's like Bedouins and, you know, like, you know, these very Middle Eastern type Jews. And, you know, it's like, I mean, like, talk about like standing out like a sore thumb. I mean, really, he's there, but he's Sir Moses Montefiore. And he goes for the first time in 1827. He will then go in 1838, 1849, 1855, 1857, 1866, and 1875 when he's 90 years old. I mean, really, I mean, just he keeps going at it. He will distribute funds to Jews throughout the four holy cities, as they are known at that time, of Tzfat, Tveria, Hebron, and Yerushalayim. But Yerushalayim will really be his passion. And one of the things that he does, or in general, is that what's been happening in Israel for the last few hundred years beforehand is that these Jewish communities that are there are impoverished. The Ottomans won't really allow Jews to engage in a lot of business activities, and so they're poor. And essentially the way these communities survive is through contributions from the diaspora. There will be some of these places, separate Ashkenazi and Sephardic communities. Ashkenazis in Eastern Europe will send funds to the Ashkenazi communities, and the Sephardim in the Mediterranean and, you know, in Western Europe will send to the Sephardic communities. And there's a whole network of shlichim, kind of fundraisers that are sent out, that are kind of directed from Istanbul, from what's called the Pikidim, there, the Jewish community there. They'll kind of coordinate these efforts. And essentially, they're living off of donations. They're studying Torah. And Montefiore goes in there and he says, you know, this is not good. This is not sustainable, right? People need to be able to take care of themselves. And he starts trying to develop methods for, essentially self-sustaining industry for the Jewish community that's in the Holy Land. And so in Jaffa, he'll plant an orchard. So the oranges, right? So kind of the precursor of Jaffa oranges, right? He'll kind of he'll lay the groundwork for that. He'll try to create groups of people that can sew and do textiles. And so that'll be kind of be trying to develop and train people how to do that. And one of the things that he also does, and it's really famous, is he builds a windmill. He builds a windmill outside the walls of Jerusalem, of course, so that Jews can grind their own wheat and hopefully have cheaper food available to them. It won't be as expensive, and they'll be easier for them to make a living. Let's see, what picture do we have here? Ah, one of the things I'll just mention is that often with him goes Lady Judith. She will go, and there's these great, you know, stories of her going with him. And again, you know, they're just like this British gentleman and lady, you know, traveling through, you know, barren, you know, kind of Israel at that time. But they're treated like royalty, and talk the throngs of people that come to greet them in the different places. And we'll talk a bit more about her connection there a little bit later. But here he builds the windmill. That's from an old newspaper from the 1800s, showing the windmill that he builds. He also builds an almshouse outside of the walls, and that's a significant. Right? He's building this outside the city walls, right? So what he's trying to encourage is that Jews should stop just living in the city walls where there's lots of overcrowding in the old city, and they should start living outside of those walls, right? This has become known as Mishkanot Sha'ananim, right? The area of Yamin Moshe, as it will then kind of be called. And those buildings are still there. They're still there. It looks a little bit different now, right? This is how it looks now. So there you can see the windmill surrounded by lots of homes and buildings that's there. And so he is kind of the father of the new yeshuv, right? He's kind of the first person to really kind of lay the groundwork to say, you know, there should be kind of modern, sustainable living among the Jewish community there. He actually tries to negotiate with the Sultan. The Jews should be able to purchase land so they can really create farms. He has difficulty with that, so it doesn't quite happen at that time. But he's already starting to think about this idea that there should be settlement in Israel for Jews that's sustainable. He's not yet thinking of a state, you know, that kind of thing, but that there should be, you know, sustainable communities in the Holy Land, and that should be a place that Jews can go to. And in fact, during the 1800s, there's an increasing number of Jews that will go there from these impoverished places in Eastern Europe, from places in North Africa, that will start going to these places because, well, their lives are so bad where they might as well at least live difficult lives in Israel. And so some of them will go there. And so it's about kind of these efforts. It's very Victorian, right? Trying to improve the lives of others. Right? But for him, it's improving the lives of other Jews. And so he, in a sense, is the father of kind of the what will become the state of Israel, right? The kind of the modern settlement in the land. So that's his involvement in world affairs. What I want to do kind of with this next section, this will be kind of the second to last part that we're going to talk about, and I apologize, we're going to go a little bit longer than usual, is to talk a little bit about what were his ethos. Because to me, well, this is the things that I think, to me, are so important, because it actually means, you know, we're not all going to be, you know, fantastically wealthy, though if we are, we should contribute to the S&P, as he did. But for those that aren't, and you know, aren't about to kind of maybe do these kind of these grandiose, you know, things like he does, I think still the figure Moses Montefiore can still be a model and can kind of be someone that we can look to for inspiration in our own lives. And so I want to talk about kind of his ethos and who he was, because I think actually sometimes he is misrepresented from different groups today about who he really was. So he was a religious man. there are stories that perhaps he was a little bit less religious in his younger life, but that apparently after this first trip to Israel, he becomes particularly religious. He starts keeping kosher strictly, putting tefillin on. He goes to synagogue every Shabbat, Monday and Thursday to hear Torah. And that becomes, you know, just part of his day-to-day life. So he's kind of, you know, traditional Orthodox Jew. He actually will be, we can call him an Orthodox Jew because it will be during his life that reform will begin. We'll talk about that. He is a Sabbath observer. In fact, when he travels, he will travel with a shochet, with a ritual slaughterer who can prepare kosher, food for him and Lady Judith, as well as his assistant. And so wherever he goes, he will make sure that he has kosher food available to him, right? Remember the story they say about him and the becoming sheriff and bringing his chicken with him, right? So again, that story was something that would have been associated with him, right, was that commitment to keeping kosher. One of the things that's really beautiful about him is his commitment to philanthropy, not just kind of in this impersonal way, but in a very personal type of way. And he's really famous for that. Let me see if this is the picture here. Yeah, sorry, it's a bit small. I couldn't find a larger image of it. But this is a picture of him in Israel at a table. And what he said was he was going to give, I forget what the coinage was, to every Jew in Israel. But you had to come in person. And so every single Jew in the Holy Land, and this is like the 1840s, had to line up, and apparently it took several days in order to be given the coin. Now, this was a way for him to actually meet them personally, hear about their concerns, what their challenges were, but also to create a census, right? And so he was able to actually get true figures on the population numbers in Israel at that time, you know, which is like less than 10,000, right, in the 1840s. It will grow a lot during the middle 1800s, even before you get to kind of 1880s, and then you really kind of think of its much larger growth, but it's growing throughout this time. But he talks about kind of how impactful that was, that he personally is giving the charity to these people himself, right, and how that he's really committed to it. And I just love it. You know, you see him there, you see Lady Judith there with that giant feather, you know, or something coming out of her hat. It must have been quite a sight for the people, for the people there. But we know that they received prayers that she should have children from some of the Kabbalists there, you know, and they were deeply touched from their from those interactions. But as I mentioned, we can call him an Orthodox Jew because he was a traditionalist. He actually was vehemently opposed to the formation of reform. In London, it was during that time that you had the West London. Is that what's called? The West London synagogue is formed, right? It's a combination of some Jews from Duke's Place and from Bevis Marks that are now living in the West, and they kind of get together and start this new modern synagogue. And even he will not permit, while there are representatives on the board of deputies from the different communities, he will not allow representatives from the Reform community while he is president to sit on the British Board of Deputies. And so he is very insistent. So this is for decades after the Reform or the Liberal community, right, I guess, I don't know what it was called at that time, essentially after the Reform community existed, that he would not allow them to have official representation. It causes a second body to be formed that could represent all of those groups. But no one's really willing to ultimately cross Montefiore. I mean, he's this force. You can't really do that. Perhaps that was, he didn't stop reform. He decided to know, ultimately was it successful or not, or was it appropriate perhaps. But we do know that it was something he cared a great deal about. In fact, one of the people who founded the synagogue, went to the synagogue, was his brother. He never spoke to his brother again. There's even a story that on his brother's deathbed, he called for Moses to come see him, and Moses sent a telegram back saying, if you're willing to kind of declare your mistake for having gone there and, committing yourself to, in a sense, return, I'll be happy to come see you. And his brother wouldn't do that, and that was it. In a sense, like a real traditionalist in that way, to the extent that it didn't matter if you were family. That was going to be a break. It was something he felt very strongly. One of the things that is also really important to him is Jewish education. He's famous for a lot of his involvements in Jewish education. One of the things that's nicely written about him is that he would give a prize at the end of the name of the community school was and is Sha'arei Tikva, on the principle of it. If anyone knows of any children who need Jewish education, please speak to me. And at the end of the year, there would be a prize day. We still do that. We're actually going to do it here at Bevis Marks this year. And he would give the gift. He would give the prize to each of the pupils there. And we know that he sponsored the publication of materials that would have been used for kind of educating the children in the community school. But it wasn't just about kind of the standard education. He also believed in higher Jewish education as well. And after the passing of his wife, Lady Judith, he founds the Lady Judith Montefiore College and in Ramsgate. And here we can see he builds a very impressive Victorian dwelling there that 10 scholars should be able to live there in comfort and devote themselves to the study of Torah. He apparently receives like thousands of applications from Jews in Eastern Europe and things like that, trying to apply to get into that. But the thing that he's really committed to is that there should not just be kind of, you know, general Jewish literacy, but that we also need experts in Jewish topics as well, right? At a time of growing, I would say, acculturation and assimilation, the Anglo-Jewry, right? He's not just being a traditionalist. He's really trying to do what he can to ensure that there will be, a highly educated traditional future to Anglo-Jewry. And his college will educate, generations of Jews, some of the current rabbis and figures in the SNP. Rabbi Levi had been part of this. Rabbi Ilya had been part of it. Chalfon, right, had been part of this as well. And so many of all the chazanim and rabbis, of a generation or two before me, essentially had been part of this. It no longer exists. The building's no longer there, and it's kind of been reinvented. We'll talk about the reinvention maybe at the end of the lecture. But these were things that were really important to him, right? So he wasn't just kind of in the present. He really had a person thinking a vision of what needed to be in place in order for there to be a future as well. And he appreciated that education is the key to ensuring that. I call that kind of his religious ethos, kind of his religious identity. But at the same time, he is not some, isolationist, type of figure at all. I mean, he walks around with his uniform. I mean, he is very British. He is, right, more British than the British. He is proud of it. He does not believe everyone should just be studying Torah and be impoverished, right? He wants to create sustainable living in the land of Israel, right? He wants there to be orchards that Jews are working, that there are farms, that there is a windmill, right? That there are people working in textiles, right? He thinks that people need to work. People need to have professions. Yes, there are people that should study Torah. He's willing to support people in the study of Torah, but part of the community also needs to be earning a living and not living off of just kind of contributions from overseas, right? And that's something he really believes in. One of the things that's also really important to him is this belief that people need to know the language of the places in which they live. And it seems that that is something he often will advocate to Jews as he travels, is that you need to teach people the language. You can't just teach your children Yiddish or whatever the language is. If you can't speak Arabic and you're living in the Holy Land, if you can't speak Russian and you live in Russia, then of course there's going to be hostility. Of course there's going to be limits to your emancipation. Right? How can you expect for the majority place in which you live to not see you as other if you can't interact with them? And that becomes something that he really advocates. There's a story that's told, again, it's one of these kind of like legend type stories, that he is invited by one of these rebbes, Hasidic rebbes in Eastern Europe, to act as an intermediary on their behalf because the government has demanded that Jews start teaching their children Polish or Russian, whatever, Hungarian, whatever the language is in this place. And they say, what a terrible thing. This is going to be the end of Judaism. That we're not going to be teaching Yiddish in our schools. We're going to be teaching Russian. That's it. Our kids are all... So there is this thing that happens. So Montefiore says to me, he goes, but is it not true, you know, Grand Rabbi, that in this book of Esther, that the story is told that Mordechai overhears Bigtan and Teresh plotting to kill Ahasuerus, right? To kill the king, and clearly he understood what they were saying. So we see that Jews knew the language that was being spoken. So you see, we should teach our children the language. And so the Hasidic Rebbe says back, and he goes, but from the fact that Bigtan and Teresh didn't think Mordechai would have understood them, must mean that in general, Jews did not know the local language. And so you see that Jews did not teach the local language. So Montefiore says back, he says, well, maybe that's true, but the fact that Mordechai did know the local language, and as a result, the Jews are saved, don't you see that it's good? You need to have Jews that know the local language. And the Rebbe says, we absolutely do. But Mr. Montefiore, Sir Moses, that's why we have you. And this becomes kind of part of this, the struggle that he has, where he's a traditional Jew. He's deeply committed to Torah and, you know, halakha, you know, those, you know, and living a traditional Jewish life. But he sees it doesn't make any sense for Jews to not have the skills and the capabilities to participate in the societies in which they live. And if you can't, then you are becoming your own barrier to success. And you can't just claim anti-Semitism and, you know, persecution if you're not willing to engage in it, right? So he kind of has this meeting of his minds with this kind of movement at that time that says, yes, we should all treat each other, we should all be equal, but you also then have to do your part as well to be part of those societies. And the last thing is charity again, is that he contributes to all kinds of causes. He's revered in Ramsgate for all of the beautiful things he does. He gives out blankets to the poor, coal to the poor before the winter. On anniversaries, on his birthdays, he'll give donations to different causes. You know, when he eventually dies, there's this like major, you know, outpouring of, even today in Ramsgate, there's still this recognition of, you know, Moses and what all he did for the people there. And so he's deeply revered for kind of that he's giving to all kinds of causes, all kinds of peoples. And so that is his, you know, he is a traditionalist, but he is an integrated Jew, right? He is a Jew that does not believe we should live in isolation, but that to be a true Jew means being a human as well, right? And that there is no contradiction between the two. You can be a human and you can be a Jew, and that actually is the ideal way to live, which always makes it funny when I see certain groups revering him who was Montefiore himself would not revere. In any case, let me conclude with his legacy. Because he has a fascinating legacy. He inspires at his death, institutions around the world are named after him. So there is, you know, Montefiore Hospital. There is, you know, like dozens of cemeteries that are named Montefiore Cemetery. There are all kinds of institutions. There's even a winery now called, you know, a wine which is called Montefiore. Right, there's all these things that are named after Montefiore. It really kind of is this, at his birth, he turns 100, he receives letters from people around the world. I mean, he's a big deal. Actually, they say reading his records is like a way to understand world Jewry at that time. Unfortunately, a lot of his records were burnt intentionally. His kind of assistant says that Montefiore said that after his death he should burn them. Who knows what's in those letters? In any case, it's a big tragedy because we lost a lot of kind of all of these international correspondents. But lots of things are named after Montefiore after his passing. Obviously, one of his great lasting contributions is the new yeshuv. It's the fact that he starts the ball rolling for modern, sustainable living in the Holy Land, which will ultimately lead to a growing modern community in Israel, and ultimately the creation of the state. One of the things that he actually does, in addition to the other building, let's mention this, is he builds the dome of Kever Rachel. That was a place that was deeply important to Lady Jutz. She found it to be a very spiritual place. So they build the famous dome that's there. Today it's surrounded by a wall, so you don't have that view, but that's in Bethlehem. And in fact, when Lady Judith dies, he builds a mausoleum in Ramsgate next to the synagogue. That looks like that, right? That is essentially a copy of what they had built in Ramsgate, and they're both buried. They're both buried in there. You can go in there and see. And there's some very lovely inscriptions about them in there. So Israel is something he is always, forever, connected with. He also leaves a very important endowment, the Montefiore Endowment, which continues to help sustain Jewish education in England. There's the Montefiore Kollel, which still exists, that trains rabbis. There's now a training, Montefiore Kollel is also training dayanim, judges, as well. They support students that are going to spend a year of study after secondary school, where they provide, material support, but also educational activities for them to round out their yeshiva and seminary studies, to kind of help infuse them with the ethos of Sir Moses. Yes, you're studying yeshiva, but you should also be part of society, right? So they continue to do a lot of important works in that regard, that are continue to be kind of inspired by Montefiore's legacy. He plays an important role, as I mentioned, in this transition, right? He is very much that kind of old world, one Jew can change the world. And at a certain point, he does it. You can see through his life perhaps a declining ability for him to do that. But he is kind of sitting on the Board of Deputies. He is starting these kind of national campaigns. And so it's, again, part of this transition time between kind of just one Jew can do anything to actually, that's the old world right now. It needs to be kind of collective efforts. We can't just leave it to one person. If we want change to happen, if we want to improve, Jewish life around the world, we collectively need to do that. And I would say finally, one of the things that he does, because he's called on, is he really connects the Jewish world, right? He makes Jews the world over aware of the plight of Jews the world over. And in that sense, really kind of creates, in a practical way, that sense of, that we need to care for each other and be responsible for one another. And that will inspire, right, all these kind of, international Jewish, philanthropic organizations that will all be engaging in kind of this collective concern for the needs of Jews, whether they're living in Iran or, in the Americas, whatever it is, that we all need to kind of look out for each other in our times of need. And that is an incredible legacy. I mentioned in last lecture that I kind of wanted to think about each of these individuals as, one of the four sons, kind of these types. And we said that Mendoza was the Ishtam, not because he is simple, but because that was Jacob, and Jacob, of course, struggled with the angel. He wrestled with him, perhaps, or boxed. So I thought that would be a good connection. I thought with Sir Moses, kind of the obvious choice would be that he's the Chacham, but he wasn't the Chacham. He, we don't think of him as the great scholar, even though he supported scholarship. Certainly not Rasha, but perhaps the She'en Lo Yodei Lish'ol, the one who does not ask, and not so much in the way that we think of that as kind of the, he's so unintelligent, he can't even ask a question. But I think of the one who doesn't ask as the one who just gets on with it. He doesn't need to ask questions. He doesn't have to kind of discuss this, discuss that. He just lives his life. And I feel like that, in a lot of ways, captures Sir Moses. Perhaps he didn't have a lot of patience for other opinions in some ways, but that also was his strength, and that he really got things done. And in that way, made a profound and a lasting impact. As I mentioned beginning, as out of great reverence for him, we continue to cordon off his seat, and only on rare occasion do we ever let anybody sit there. I won't go through some of the more recent figures to do so, but there continues to be great reverence for him, and I think to some degree, the more we've moved away from him, it starts to feel a little bit silly of, oh, there was this rich guy who gave a lot of money, and kind of it becomes somewhat meaningless. But actually, who he was and what he represents, I actually think is something that we should ensure that more people know about, because I think he is a model for Jews for the future that are increasingly perhaps under attack you know, not, you know, that this kind of, someone can be deeply committed to tradition, but deeply integrated with society, somehow that type of Jew has become unusual. And that is what Anglo-Jewry is. And it's up to us to ensure that we continue to model ourselves after a Sir Moses and ensure that that is the future of Anglo-Jewry, that the future of Anglo-Jewry are people like Sir Moses. If we can succeed at that, we will all be the better for it. Yes?
I was just going to an observation of something that you said. I grew up in Hove. When Hove expanded in the 1870s, 8 roads were named after eminent Victorians. One was Dubbyville, and the other was Montefiore. In the early 1950s, the fledgling Reform Synagogue on the south coast was looking to expand into another building. And something happened, it came available on Montefiore Road.
Yeah.
And they didn't get planning permission. And the rabbi, whose daughter was actually a friend of mine, is reported to have said that even beyond the grave, it's going to carry on. So 18 years afterwards, they still realize that it didn't like them.
Yes.
It's a very, very pleasant place to be.
There you have it. Yes, exactly. The next lecture